you know, counterfactuals are easy for historians because you can never be wrong.
Of course.
But I think that if Washington had fallen somehow, then the game really was going to be up.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, and welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Rick Wilson. I am delighted to be joined today by Rick Atkinson, one of the preeminent military historians of our time, and a guy who's written some of my very favorite books about the history of this great country of ours. And Rick, I want to thank you first off. The whole Liberation series about World War II is absolutely unbelievable. Long Gray Line, and so much else. You have now written a new series about the Revolutionary War, which, of course, I am a Revolutionary War nerd, and it is called The British Are Coming. This is the first volume in a trilogy. This is 1775 to 1777, and I want to start out by asking you the question, what have Americans fundamentally forgotten about this unbelievably important period in our history? I think we've kind of compressed it over time into like a sort of Paul Revere, Valley Forge, done. And I don't think people have the same granularity anymore. Is that where what led you to write this series?
Well, first, thanks for having me and talking to me this morning, Rick. And I should mention that volume two of this trilogy, Knock Wood, hope it will be a trilogy, is just published. Volume two is called The Fate of the Day, and it's about the middle years of the Revolution. You know, I think that there are a couple of issues here that you've touched on. One is that we're just now entering the semi-quincentennial, which sounds like a medical procedure. It's actually the 250th anniversary of our country's founding. And over 250 years, the American Revolution has kind of a gauzy look to it. It seems so remote. It's like a faded lithograph in some ways. People don't feel the emotional connection to it that they do, the sense of empathy that they do, say for the Civil War, certainly for World War II. I think that that revolutionary generation just seems very remote to people in 2025. The other issue certainly is that a lot of mythification has occurred over those 250 years. The founders are either encrusted in or embalmed in reverence, or they're condemned for their manifest flaws. And in fact, they're much more complex and more interesting than that. So one of my objectives from the beginning, and I started this trilogy in 2013, has been to try to convey really what the war was like. It was a civil war, our first civil war, with all of the nastiness that conveys. And second, the principal characters and others that most people have never heard of are really very, very compelling as characters, not to mention as propellants in our national history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one thing you really do capture here is there's a lot more layers to people like Washington and Gage, and on both sides of the equation, where the historical flattening, I guess, you sort of unflatten it. These are flawed people. These are unbelievably brave people. Many of them are brilliant people. Many of them are very, very human. Lay it out for us as we open in the first act of this play, because again, I think Americans, and that's maybe to blame, our civic education's to blame for this, but I think a lot of Americans don't understand all the predicates that led to the Revolutionary War. Talk to us a little bit about, on the dawn of this story, where America's at, where Britain is at in the world, and why this was such an imposing idea to go up against the British Empire.
Yeah, imposing is the right word too. Well, if we go to 1775, the Americans have about 2.5 million people in the 13 colonies. 500,000 of them, 20%, are mm-hmm. enslaved blacks.
Right.
We have, as a colonial adjunct to the first British Empire, which was created in 1763 with Britain's triumph over France and Spain in the Seven Years' yep. War. We call it the French and Indian War. Mm-hmm. We have largely been left alone for the better part of a century. There's kind of a benign neglect that has been Britain's approach to the colonies.
Sure.
And that ends in 1763, partly because Britain is deeply in debt with war debts. They're looking to recoup some of that money by imposing further taxes on the colonies. They've also sent regiments from the British Army. Now, Britain has about three times the population of America. It has a large professional army with lots of experience fighting in the Seven Years' War. It has the greatest navy, the Royal Navy, that the world has ever seen. It's very imposing. And so when some of those regiments are sent here, primarily to be stationed on the Western frontier to keep the Indians and the colonists away from each other so that there's not further war between between these two peoples. And the effort to tax the colonies gains steam. Well, there's resistance, and there's resistance to the point of, you know, from a British point of view, of treason, because it's a refusal to adhere to dictates of Parliament. King George III, he's a constitutional monarch. He's not the sinister ninny who prances across the stage in Hamilton every night. And his primary concern is to ensure that Parliament is given its due, that Parliament has sovereign authority. So this is all going to come to a collision in April of 1775 when the first shots are fired at Lexington, Concord on April 19th.
That collision, it the odds, as you said, the Royal Navy is this unbelievably imposing, powerful force. It was absolutely unparalleled in the world. There was nothing else even remotely like it. The British had enormous resources. And the country itself was still divided at that time. The revolution did not spring up as something that every American embraced immediately.
Right.
There certainly were folks who wanted to stay loyal to the crown. So after this moment, as these things start to, you know, catalyze in the Boston area and you know, more broadly as well, there's also this moment where we start to see George Washington emerge as a character in this, as the Constitutional Convention. They're starting to, this is this youngish guy from Virginia. Talk to us about how the leadership structures on both sides looked in the beginning of the Revolutionary War, because I think people have forgotten a lot of the interplay between the characters that were there.
Yeah. Well, on the British side, first of all, they do have this experienced army. Most of the officers, including the senior officers, have considerable combat experience from fighting the French, the Spanish. Commander-in-chief for the British is a man named Thomas Gage. He's had a lot of experience in America. He's married to an American. Margaret Kemble is from New Jersey. He has sent three major generals to be his deputies. They include William Howe, who is going to succeed him as a commander-in-chief, Henry Clinton, who's going to be commander-in-chief for the British cause longer than anybody, for 4 years. So this is part of the imposing nature of this enemy we're suddenly fighting. On the other side, George Washington is chosen by the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia to become the new commander-in-chief of the new Continental Army. It's brand new. It's a creation that is called a Continental Army in the hope that it will represent the Continental forces. It's mainly in July of 1775 when Washington arrives in Cambridge outside of Boston to take command. It's mainly a New England militia force. And they send a Virginian in part to try to bind together the 13 colonies to serve as a recruiting tool to bring Southerners into the cause. What we see in Washington is somebody who's had 5 years of pretty substantial military experience as a Virginia militia colonel, always under superior British command during the French and Indian War. He's seen a lot of combat. He narrowly escapes a couple times with his life early on, but he's been out of uniform for 16 years. So he shows up at Cambridge, July 2nd, 1775. He's got a lot to learn. He doesn't know much about artillery. Even though Jefferson says he's the greatest horseman of his age, he doesn't know much about cavalry. He knows nothing about Continental logistics. More important, I think, and he's a quick learner, more important is he doesn't really understand emotionally, viscerally, the sacrifice that is being made by these New England militia troops who have left their farms, their families, their shops to join the cause at his side. He's got several hundred slaves at Mount Vernon taking care of business for him while he's away. Over the course of his lifetime, there will be at least 577 slaves at Mount Vernon, which is a whole other issue. You cannot square that circle morally. So one of the things Washington is going to have to learn, he's going to have to develop, is this mystical bond between leader and led, because it's going to be necessary over the course of an 8-year war. And as you suggest, it is a civil war. About 20% of the 2 million white Americans remain loyal to the crown. So that's a big problem for Washington and for the Continental cause. So he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders, and he begins to try to address these many, many, many problems in July 1775. Fortunately for us, he's up to the task. He's very, very capable. So that's what we're going to see play out over the first couple books that I've written here.
So, and in the beginning, so we have, Lexington and Concord, the first shots fired, and we move on to Bunker and Breed's Hill. And it's a moment, I think, where the rest of the country said, this might be harder than it looks. This won't go, it looked like the British, could start to bring that mass of manpower, material, money against them in a way. Talk to us about how that phase of this early going shaped Washington's ideas of how to fight this war.
Yeah, Rick, and I think that's also a pretty astute observation. The folks who really come to the realization that this is going to be harder than it looks is the British. Bunker Hill actually fought on Breed's Hill, town right across the Charles River from Boston, June 17th, 1775. The British recapture about a square mile of rebel-held territory. They have more than 1,000 casualties, 226 British dead. It's a stunning bloodletting. General Gage, who's the British commander, basically writes to his political masters in London, this is going to be very hard. This is going to be difficult for a lot of reasons, including logistics. If we venture outside of our own lines in Boston, we get ambushed. So we're going to need everything that we need to be shipped from Ireland or England. That includes fodder for horses, gunpowder, opium, the whole everything, uniforms. So they recognize how difficult it's going to be, and Britain really wants a quick war. They've started this really with the presumption that we can get this over in a year, maybe two. And they want that in part because they don't want the other European powers to get involved. They don't want it to become, as it becomes, a global war. On the American side, I think there are very few illusions that this is going to be simple. There's a recognition that we are fighting this world power, that we're fighting a world power that has many resources, including sophisticated financing of military operations, that enormous fleet, 400 warships that we talked about. Americans basically have no navy. And all the other things that Washington, his subordinate officers, and the rank and file are facing right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the navy part of this, that they really had that mobility advantage at first, at least. America had like cutters and whaleboats and small craft essentially against ships of the line.
Yeah.
And again, it's like for Americans today, that's the Death Star, folks, back in that era. That's the Death Star. Ship of the line was the Death Star.
Yeah. A ship of the line is basically a large warship. It's usually with at least 50 guns. Some of the, like the Victory had 100 guns. Also, these are enormous. They're the most complex machines of the 18th century. The Congress agrees to build 13 frigates. They basically have about 40 guns. None of those 13 frigates is a factor in the war. All of them, all 13 of them, are destroyed or captured by the end of the war. So, we end up with a navy that's not really a navy. It's privateers. They're given commissions by Congress or the respective states to go out and act as pirates. Now, they're very important, and they play hob with British shipping and even with the Royal Navy, but we don't really have, even though there is a United States Navy, it's a poor shadow of what the British have.
We'll be right back. And now, back to the show. So Boston and New York are big characters in this early going in the war, because they are the two major cities. They are the two sort of centers of gravity in a lot of ways. The war starts to shift south toward the end of this part of the story. Talk to us about how, you know, we end up with because we don't, I don't think people appreciate how difficult travel was in the time.
Yeah.
Where, you know, going from Boston to New York today is an hour on the shuttle, or 3.5 hours or 2.5 hours on the Acela, not 2 weeks.
Right.
On shitty, muddy roads, you know, in wilderness, et cetera. The British recognize they can move troops, they can move logistics, they can do that by sea. The Americans basically have to hustle on land to do all this. And talk to us about how this, in the early going, where the war was being fought in that, in the, as New England, as it shifts down towards New York.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you're right. The travel times are almost incomprehensible to us today, not to mention communication times. Just across the Atlantic, 3,000 miles of open ocean in the age of sail, you're lucky if you make it from Boston or New York to Britain in 6 weeks. It often took 3 months. It takes even longer sailing back, generally into the prevailing winds. So it can take months and months for orders to be transmitted and acknowledged. And by the time those orders are received, they're often out of date. So there's a real constriction, both traveling by land and traveling by sea. Yeah, the war starts, as we've been discussing, around Boston. The British are surrounded in Boston. They're eventually evicted from Boston in March of 1776, when Washington identifies a 25-year-old overweight Boston bookseller named Henry Knox, who's got a genius for gunnery, and sends him off to Fort Ticonderoga to bring back some cannons that the British have abandoned there when Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain has been captured. And those guns provide the necessary firepower to cause the British to evacuate Boston. And then the war is going to shift to New York, and New York in some ways is the centerpiece of the colonies at this point. And it's going to go better for the British there. They're going to land on Staten Island. They're going to land on Long Island. The Battle of Long Island is a catastrophe for the Americans. Washington does not show good generalship there. Mm-mm. He misreads the ground. He gets outflanked. He nearly loses the whole army. He slips away in the
fog.
In the fog. The fog on the East River hides his retreat to Manhattan Island. So, and then they're going to get evicted from Manhattan Island. There's another catastrophe at Fort Washington on the Upper West Side, on the overlooking the Hudson, where 3,000 American troops are captured. The entire garrison there. And the first volume in this trilogy is going to end with Washington retreating across New Jersey, the British chasing him, and then across the Delaware River into Pennsylvania. And out of desperation, sheer desperation, on Christmas night, he attacks the Hessian, the German garrison in Trenton, surprises them, and destroys the garrison. He does it again. He crosses the Delaware a second time and surprises the British rear guard in Princeton, and destroys that garrison. So finally, a couple of wins for the home team, and they all go into winter quarters. So there's several months, and that's the end of The British Are Coming, Volume 1. And then in the spring, things are going to shift, and a lot happens then. The British now recognizing that they're really in it, and they're in for a big, protracted fight, send an army from Canada down Lake Champlain, capturing Fort Ticonderoga, evicting the garrison there, and then they're in the Hudson Valley. And the whole plan initially is to come down the Hudson basically to either Albany or New York and sever the New England colonies from the Middle Atlantic states.
Right.
That's a pretty good plan. The problem is that the main British army in New York goes the other direction. General Howe, now in command, takes it into his head, and it's approved by London, that, Philadelphia, which is the largest city in America, is where it's at. And he takes his army, and they sail south, and it's a very long, torturous route, because they come up through the Delaware Bay and Delaware River to Philadelphia. They go all the way around to the Chesapeake Bay, the middle of the summer. It's brutally hot. And so the war is going to center on Philadelphia there, while the army that has come out of Canada under General Burgoyne is in the Hudson Valley. This is strategically incoherent.
Right.
And it's going to cost them big time, because that army in the Hudson Valley under Burgoyne at Saratoga, first at Bennington and then at Saratoga in two battles, is going to be destroyed. 8,000 men. 8,000 have come out of Canada, and there are no British and German forces left there, because they've all been either killed or captured. Now, at this point, the British are recognizing, oh boy, what have we gotten ourselves into? They do capture Philadelphia, but it's a kind of a hollow victory for them, because Congress has fled, as Congress is wont to do when they're threatened.
Sure.
You've got a comfortable winter in Philadelphia if you're General Howe, but it's strategically not very important. So the war has begun to move to the south. There are British victories at Brandywine and at Germantown before the capture of Philadelphia, a stunning surprise attack at Paoli. So the British are racking up some victories. Strategically, however, it's not clear how they're going to bring this thing to a close.
Right. And at that point, even Britain has limits on its logistics, its money, its manpower can deploy into this. We'll be right back. And now, back to the show. I want to loop back for 1 second, and as you discussed, the British chased George Washington for weeks on end, and at any point, if it had gone wrong and they had managed to capture him, would the war have ended at that moment for the U.S.?
It wouldn't have been good, Rick. there's no doubt about it. I mean, at one point, when Washington is crossing into Pennsylvania, his army's down to 3,000 men, fewer than 3,000 men. He's been chased out of New York, out of New Jersey. He writes to his brother and says, I think the game is pretty near up. There's no obvious replacement for him. I mean, he has quite quickly become the indispensable man. Now, there are people who've got questions about his generalship. I think legitimate questions. He's got more losses than wins, certainly. But Nathaniel Green, lapsed Quaker from Rhode Island, will eventually be identified, and is identified early by Washington, as second only to Washington as the indispensable man in the Continental Army. But that hasn't really happened yet, and Green hasn't proved himself to be that potential successor if Washington, and if one of the errant bullets actually hits Washington or he's captured or whatever. So, yeah, I think, counterfactuals are easy for historians, because you can never be wrong.
Of course.
But I think that if Washington had fallen somehow, then the game really was going to be up.
Yeah, I think it's always been one of those interesting sort of, alt history questions. And again, I want to loop back also. So he runs, and he runs fast, and his army is diminished. It is worn down. It is frayed around the edges. And again, winning those two quick battles and taking Princeton shifted the war. But did it shift Washington? Did he feel a different? Was there a difference? Did he feel like was he re-energized by those victories in a way that made a meaningful difference in the war?
It's an interesting thing to watch, and it's an interesting thing to try to get your arms around as a historian. I think in volume two, which has just come out, The Fate of the Day, what we see in Washington is that he grows in confidence over these middle years of the war, beginning obviously with those victories at Trenton and Princeton. His relationship with his troops deepens, and the army changes a lot. So he's learning on the fly. It's not yeoman farmers and shopkeepers and freeholders in New England forming the army. It's much different. It's the young,
systematized.
It's the army is really composed of the young and unattached who are looking for the $6 a month that a private earns. Washington grows more confident in his relationship with his political masters. He's at pains to reassure them that they are his political masters, Congress, state governors, committees of safety, all the levers of power that he needs, both for recruiting purposes, to provide him with supplies, and to provide him with the moral support that's required. So, you know, I think that we see in Washington, and it's quite a fascinating study in leadership generally, not just military leadership, somebody that rises to the occasion. He grows into the job.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And you know, from our point of view, thank goodness for it.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, Rick Atkinson, I want to thank you so much for coming on the Lincoln Project podcast today. Folks, history matters. Volume 1 is The British Are Coming. Volume 2, out now, is The Fate of the Day. This is a brilliant, in-depth history of the Revolutionary War. It will tell you more about the character of the men who fought on both sides of it and more about the history than you might be remembering from college history classes. And I really recommend it. I really think it's a very valuable perspective. And Rick is a brilliant writer. Thank you again, my friend. And we'll look forward to having you on the show again soon.
Thank you, Rick. I really appreciate it. And I enjoyed the conversation very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
The Lincoln Project podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.